Oh my goodness. this means that I'm being recorded. I take all the responsibility, but none of the blame. For anything that may come out of this mouth. So Ty was mentioning that last week I was beating people with my heart. It reminded me of a poem, a Rumi poem. In the slaughterhouse of love, they kill only the best. None of the maimed or deformed. Do not be afraid of this dying. Whoever's not killed for love is dead meat.
Great poem. Never heard of
it. It's an actual Rumi poem.
Terrific, yeah. Do it again.
In the slaughterhouse of love. Yeah. Almost sick. It'd be a good song, huh? In the slaughterhouse of love, they kill only the best. Do not be afraid of this dying. Whoever's not killed for love is dead meat. Now, what the original Arabic or whatever it was said, I don't know. That phrase "dead meat" sounds like an English colloquialism, but maybe not. Maybe something quite literal.
Who wrote that?
Rumi. Rumi. It's a Rumi poem. Rumi. Yeah. Okay. And last week I spoke about the pain of the world and about the fault line of the pain of the world running through each and every human heart, my heart, your heart. The pain of the world is not just in Burma. The pain of the world is not just Rwanda, Darfur. No, it's the fault line is in each heart. And getting in touch with that pain I spoke of as being a form of love. And I said at one point that what I feel could actually ultimately make a difference for our world is a critical mass of love. And I think I noticed a few eyes rolling as I said that. Because the word love is bandied around quite carelessly, frivolously maybe sometimes. It, you know, has some, maybe a hallmark ring to it. But I tried to expound upon it in such a way to show that how I mean it, it's something rather rigorous and something rather daunting, but still something very, very necessary for peace, for personal peace, and for any hope of peace in our society, in our country, in our world, is this type of love, which I intend to hopefully expound upon further. Start off with a koan, or a Zen story. It's both in the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Serenity. Student asks a teacher, "What does Avalokiteshvara do with all those hands and eyes?" And last week I told a story of how she acquired all those hands and eyes. She kept on trying to save all beings from hell, and her head kept blowing up. And her head kept blowing up so many times that Amitabha Buddha gave her a multiplicity of hands and eyes and heads and put his own head on top as kind of like an insurance stamp in the future. So in this story, a student comes up to the teacher and says, "Well, okay, she's got all these hands and eyes. Well, what does she do with all these hands and eyes? What is the nature of compassion? What is compassion? What is love?" is the question. And the teacher said, "It's like looking for the pillow in the dark. It's like looking for a pillow in the dark. And the student said, I understand. And the teacher said, well, what do you understand? The student says, all over the body is hands and eyes. The teacher said, well, that's pretty good, but it's not quite it. That's only about 80%. Well, teacher, what would you say? The teacher said, throughout the body is hands and eyes. Or another way that I've heard it said is, the body is nothing but hands and eyes. So what is the difference between all over the body is hands and eyes, and throughout the body is hands and eyes? What is the difference? I think the difference between a Hallmark sentimentalist type of love and a rigorous, daunting, slaughterhouse of love kind of love. And let me tell another story to explain what I'm getting at. The story is about the sixth patriarch and how the sixth patriarch became the sixth patriarch. And I'm going to probably paraphrase it and not get the whole poem's verbatim correct, but it's something like this. The fifth patriarch felt that he was getting old, about to retire, needed to find a successor. So he decided to discover his successor by initiating a poetry contest. Please write a poem, express your understanding. So the head monk, the one whom everyone suspected was the one most likely to receive the transmission, wrote a poem, and it was posted. He said, write this poem, post it up on the wall for all to see, and the best poem will be the one who should receive the transmission. So the fifth patriarch wrote a poem, something like, Bodhi is a mirror. The body is the mirror's stand. Polish it diligently, the mirror of the mind, so no dust can alight, so no dust can obscure the reflection of the mirror. That's the essence of the poem. Bodhi, awakening, the mind with a capital M, is a mirror. And the body, our practice, our sitting posture, our zazen, is the mirror stand. Our effort is to keep dust from alighting on the mind, on the mirror of the mind. So that was the fifth patriarch's poem. So the sixth patriarch, from the story, didn't get to, he was working in the kitchen pounding rice. And the story, and bear in mind the story is highly polemical, you know, asserting the value of one school over another. So some of the, it's very hagiographical, very kind of like exaggerated, but, and most scholars think it's not really feasible that a monk like the sixth patriarch could literally be illiterate, no pun intended. But the story is that he was illiterate, pounding rice in the kitchen, and wasn't yet able to sit meditation with the community. He was a worker monk. Wasn't deemed worthy enough yet to practice zazen. But he happened to be walking by the wall where all the poems were posted, and he read the poems, and he read the fifth patriarch's poem, and said, well, that's pretty good, but not quite it. To himself, maybe. And then he persuaded somebody he wanted to dictate a poem and put it up anonymously. And he persuaded somebody to take his poem. And his poem went something like, there is no mirror. Mm-hmm. And there's no stand. Where could any dust ever alight to begin with? That's the sixth patriarch's poem, you know, Shunya, emptiness. And so, and he posted the poem, or had his friend post the poem. And then the next day, or at some point, the fifth patriarch wanders by, sees that poem, sees it, rips it from the wall, says, "Who wrote this rubbish?" The sixth patriarch's, the future sixth patriarch's poem. "Who wrote this rubbish?" Tears it up. This, no, that's not that. "Oh, but this poem, this fifth patriarch's poem of polishing the mirror, excellent. That's an excellent poem. All of you, the whole community, that's how you should practice this fifth patriarch's poem. Keep the dust off your mirrors. This is how to practice." That was his public statement. But in private, he went to his Jisha, or his assistant, and says, "Find out who wrote this poem. The one about no mirror, no body, no dust. And find out and have him come see me." And so then he said, "You have your understanding surpasses anybody else in the community. So, you know, don't tell anybody, because if you tell them, they're going to be jealous. They're going to hurt you. I'm going to give you the robe and the bowl, but you know, just go away." "Well, go away with this robe and bowl. You know, don't let anybody know that I've given you the transmission. You know, they'll hurt you. You know, they'll be jealous. So, very secret transmission." But the thing that's interesting is that even though the fifth patriarch decided that the sixth patriarch had the understanding to receive the transmission, he heartily recommended to his community to do the dust polishing practice. And I think it's very important that we do dust polishing practice. But what is the dust? What is the dust? Now, many times when people hear about this, there's one understanding of the dust being kleshas, the dust being mental disturbances, vibrations in the mind. Like, you know, you have a lake, and if the lake is smooth and still, you can see the reflection of the trees. But if there's ripples, you can't see the reflection of the trees. And so the practice is to calm the mind, to still the mind, to still the kleshas, and get this calm, serene type of mind that can clearly reflect the sound of the traffic, the sound of the crickets. Because there's no kleshas, there's no disturbing elements within the mind. That's one understanding of dust polishing practice. But there's another understanding of dust polishing practice and mirror mind. When we calm the mind, we hope to see the reflection of the beautiful trees and the clouds. And enjoy the peace of the calm mind. But when the surface of the lake is calm, no ripples, we also might see on the bottom of the lake the old tires and rusty tin cans that have fallen into the bottom of the lake and sunk to the bottom. That is also a virtue of a calm mind. Seeing the stuff that the busyness of the mind covers over, and I touched upon this last week. So one way of understanding mirror polishing practice is to have the settledness and the openness to see clearly what arises, whatever it might be, including kleshas. Kleshas being mental disturbance, sometimes called afflictive emotions, sometimes a little more confusedly called unwholesome mental states, where that gets into a good, bad kind of thing, get confusing. But the root meaning is anything that causes a disturbance, some sort of vibration in the mind. So one way of looking at mirror polishing is to be able to see whatever arises. The beautiful trees, the rusty tin cans and used tires that lie deep within. that we're either too busy or too deliberately, consciously, or unconsciously distracting ourselves from seeing. And the dust is that distraction. The dust is that restlessness, that busyness, that unwillingness to be still and let what wants to come, come. So that is throughout the body, hands and eyes. You can hear the traffic, you can hear the grief in the heart. Just we see everything, outside and inside. We're still enough to reflect throughout the body, not just outside, but inside as well.